Okay, so I would like to thank the organizers for inviting me to give a talk here. It's very nice to be at the University of Rennes at the RISA, but today is also a very special occasion, and I'm very honored to be able to give a talk today. I would like to start this by congratulations to Professor Harel and Professor Wilski for the honorary degree they will receive tomorrow. And then I would like to congratulate IRISA, University of Rennes, for such a fantastic choice of distinguished scientists. As a matter of fact, now I think you understand why I needed two projectors for this talk. And it is really a pity we don't have a third projector, because I would like to congratulate IRISA on the 30th anniversary, okay? I know of the work by Professor Wilski, but I am really well familiar with the work by David Harel in computer science, and really his contributions are amazing. He satisfies some of the criteria for any honor in a very exceptional way. So in his life, he introduced several areas of research in computer science, which keeps many, many people very busy and happy. He has solved very difficult problems. And maybe to say, I don't want to say these things that will be surely said at the Laudatio tomorrow, but what I want to say is that he satisfies one of these criteria, that if he would not be there, then a number of areas of computer science would be much poorer today. And on a more personal note, I just want to say that I really cherish our friendship, David. Okay, so the interests of David are very broad, and one of the areas he's interested is interaction of computer science or informatics and biology. I would like to remind all of you in the audience here that computer science is not only a science or skill of making gadgets for information and communication technology, but it's also fundamental science of information processing. And in this function, it interacts with many areas where information processing is very important, and typical area today is biology. David has an interest also in this interaction, and has this wonderful project on which should end up with a complete simulation of C. elegans, the most elegant of all worms that we know. Okay? So I have chosen to give a talk on a biological topic in the way of where we study information processing in biological systems. And so the title of my talk is Gene Assembly in Ciliates, and that's an example of natural computing. So let me begin then by spending some time on natural computing. And the definition of natural computing is computing taking place in nature, or human-designed computing inspired by or gleaned from nature. Of the second line of research, there are many examples, some of them older and some of them quite new, in computer science. Evolutionary computing that takes its paradigms from the theory of evolution, neural networks that takes paradigms from the working of the central nervous system and the brain, DNA computing, or more appropriately, molecular computing, which takes paradigms from the molecular biology, and quantum computing. There are many, many other pieces of research, but these are areas that are quite well established by today within computer science. What I'll be talking about today goes more in the first line, when you want to understand basic life processes as some kind of computations. So here is an illustration of natural computing from the cover of Natural Computing Journal by my favorite artist, Dadara. And it shows a part of natural computing where nature is feeding computers with the best it has, with DNA. So as I announced in the abstract, I would like to have this talk for a broad audience of IRISA here, and it is self-contained. So I will start with a crash course on DNA molecules. In what I'll be presenting will be having a lot of concrete manipulations of these molecules, and I would like to make sure that we have the same understanding of basic terms. Actually, this will be only basic terms of about DNA molecules, so it will be crash course, a really short one. I also apologize that I will be talking from now on a bit faster to squeeze this in a short time of the lecture. Okay, so we'll start with the simplest DNA molecule, and this is a single-stranded DNA. And for the purpose of this lecture, the single-stranded DNA molecule may be illustrated in the way shown here. So what you have here is a backbone, which is an alternation of phosphate sugar molecules here. And then on each sugar molecule, you have a base hanging down. And what you have to know is that there are four possible bases, A, C, G, and T, which are abbreviations of quite complicated chemical names, which you don't have to know. What you have to know for sure, and many of you know, that these four bases really come in two pairs. A and T feel big affinity to each other, and so do C and G. They are called complementary pairs, and this complementarity is perhaps the most basic observation about made by Watson and Crick in their famous discovery of the structure of DNA. Therefore, it's called the Watson-Crick complementarity. So this is a structure of a single-stranded DNA molecule. What I should also stress here is that there is a polarity here, or orientation. One end of this molecule is, in chemical terms, dramatically different from the other one. And the one that has a phosphate on this is called the 5' end, and this is called 3' end. As a matter of fact, this molecule, I have indicated these dots here, this is a polymer made of monomers, each this triplet, phosphate sugar and a base, phosphate sugar and a base. This here are nucleotides, which are monomers, and they are chained to form a single-stranded molecule. Once you know the structure of a single-stranded molecule, the double-stranded molecule is really, the structure can be easily explained. So what you have here is you have one single-stranded molecule and another one. And now these two molecules are bonded together by very weak hydrogen bonds here. There are two conditions for this to form double-stranded molecule. I've been waving my hand in this direction and this one, because if one of the strands has an orientation 5', 3', the other one should have an opposite orientation. Biologists use the name antiparallel here, which doesn't make much sense for a mathematician, but that's what they say. And then those are very weak bonds, but many of the weak magnets will keep this in a good, steady fashion. I should indicate here that these bonds between nucleotides, phosphodiester bonds, which are indicated by these dots, that are very strong bonds. And the fact that these are very strong and those here are very weak form the basics of DNA genetic engineering, really. So what is very convenient for my lecture, for what I'll be talking about later, is to see this double-stranded molecule as a standing picket fence, the one that you put in France when you have Tour de France on the side to be sure that cyclists are separated from the public demonstration. So you have an upper bar and a lower bar, and you have these pickets, and the pickets are these complementary pairs, and those backbones are upper and lower bars, okay? Now, these are maybe the nicest drawings I ever made, and this is a nice notation, but you really need more than such a graphical notation, and there is a very obvious notation actually introduced immediately after the discovery of the structure of DNA by biologists. So if you take a single-stranded molecule, then any two single-stranded molecules of the same length, so to say, will be identical on the backbone. Everything is the same, except that they may have various combination of bases hanging down. So in order to specify such a molecule, you need to just write the sequence of bases. And so here it is A, C, G, C, and that's what we have here. If I wouldn't give you this decoration here, you wouldn't know where is the 5' prime and 3' prime end. That would be worthless. So I just say that this really is on the 5' prime end. Therefore, this must be a 3' prime end. Biologists use an arrow here. And they use arrow in a 5' prime, 3' prime direction because it's a direction where almost exclusively all the DNA processing in nature takes place. So nature favors 5' prime, 3' prime direction. And we'll use here the best of all notations, no decoration whatsoever, but the left to right reading of this molecule corresponds to the 5' prime, 3' prime direction. I remember once giving a lecture in Israel, and I said here, in this notation, the natural reading from left to right corresponds to natural direction. There were a lot of comments from the audience, and so I'm not doing this anymore, especially that David is here. Okay? It is 5 because there are 5 carbon atoms. This really indicates carbon atoms. And the best way to see this is that each of these 3 of them, 1 prime, 3 prime, and 5 prime, are attachment points. It attaches through carbon. And mathematical comment would be that you can really see that biologists like primes. They number them like that. Okay, so once we have a notation for a single-stranded molecule, the notation for a double-stranded molecule is obvious because you have one strand and then you have another one. And if for this one I use a string, then I will use what we call a double string. So this is A, C, G, C, which is the upper string, and this is the lower one. And you need to indicate the orientation of these two strings. This string denotes one of the strands in a specific orientation. So 5' prime is here. That means 3' prime must be here. That means the other one has opposite orientation. 5' prime must be here, and 3' prime must be here. And then biologists would just put an arrow here, and we'll use again the same thing, which relates to the upper string here. The upper string denotes one of the two strands in a 5' prime, 3' prime orientation. Excuse me?
What gives the double-stranded direction? Since double-stranded is fully symmetric.
The double-stranded molecule does not have a direction. Each of the single strands has a direction. You indicate direction of one of the strands. So what I show you here are, this is illustration of the structure of DNA molecule for the purpose of explaining this here, and maybe really this is a little bit answer to a question by Moshe here, is that in nature, the molecule is not linear, as all journalists know, and many people also, that the double-strand molecule forms this famous double helix when one strand is winding around the other one, and as you can see, one of them is 5' prime, 3' prime direction, and the other one has an opposite direction. And you can see this as a kind of a ladder where the ranks of this ladder are those complementary nucleotides, G and C, T and A, C and G, and so on. There is another here notation often shown also, which has a little bit more of a chemical structure, and there exists the third version of DNA, which is called the silk version. I have this on my tie here, and this is what I use in the breaks of the lecture to explain the structure of DNA to the students. In those of you, I cannot see anything because of this light here, but those of you that can see this and are familiar with DNA can see that this is replicating DNA, and so very often I expect another tie. Okay? I want to cover a couple of more topics in my crash course, and one is very important, and this is inversion. Inversion is operation on both molecules and on the notation. And the good way to explain it is when you look on the structure of a double-stranded molecule. So when I write a notation for this, Then I take upper string and lower string. Upper and lower exists only in notation, not in molecular soup. And then I choose one of these strands and I put this as an upper string. I write this, okay? But if you have chosen this one as the upper one, somebody else could have chosen this one and write this as the upper one. You just pick up a molecule and you choose one of these strands to be written as an upper string and lower string. And what you notice that the relationship between, if I write this in this position, remember the standing pick offense, or in this one, then the relationship between one notation or the other one is 180 degree point rotation. In principle, for every double strand molecule, you have two notations depending which strand you choose to represent as the upper string. If these two notations would coincide, then biologists would say that they have a palindrome. So a very different notion of palindrome than in linguistics, okay? So I've been showing you the DNA molecules double-stranded as perfect duplexes. It means everything was there. All of those strong bonds in a backbone, phosphodiester bonds, were there, and every nucleotide in one strand has the partner in the other one, so all the hydrogen bonds were here. But in nature and in genetic engineering, there are all kinds of imperfections, and they play very useful role. So one of them is, for example, nick. In one of the strands or the other one, in both of them, you'll be missing here a strong bond between consecutive nucleotides. Well, we don't worry about this. Our living cells do not worry about this because there is a natural enzyme called ligase, which is crazy about repairing DNA, just repairing nicks. It slides along the DNA molecules all the time, and whenever it discovers a nick, it just seals this off. And in a test tube, in all our manipulations in genetic engineering, we often use just protectively a lot of ligase. The other imperfection is a sticky end. You may have a molecule at one end or the other, or the both of them, you will have a sequence of nucleotides which do not have partners in the other one. And this is very important. This is called sticky ends. They are called sticky for the following reason. I have here an illustration for you. If I have two DNA molecules, I have this one, which has here on this 3' end, it has a sticky end ATC, and I have another molecule that in the other strand here, it has a sticky end GAT. You see, these two are complementary, G and C, A and T are complementary, A and T, and they have opposite polarity here. If they are in the vicinity of each other, they bump and they establish hydrogen bonds, and that will keep them for a short while, which is enough for ligase to establish the strong bonds here that are missing. And so from this and this molecule, you are getting, using sticky ends and ligase, you are getting a new molecule. This is what happens all the time, and both in living cells and in genetic engineering. So hereby I would like to end this first part of my talk, and this is basic facts about DNA molecules. I now will proceed to the topic of my lecture, and I will introduce you to wonderful organisms, actually very famous. They are called ciliates. They are eukaryotes, single-cell organisms. They are very ancient. Their age is estimated 2 billion years old. It's a very rich group. At that moment, we know about 10,000 genetically different organisms in this group. Biologists think that we're more like 50 or 100,000. And they are very important from the evolutionary point of view. Every biologist studying evolution knows about them because they developed unusual features in the evolution which are very unique. Therefore, if there is anybody in the audience that knows about ciliates, I'll be talking about Stichotrix group of ciliates because the features I use are the best developed in them, and they're also the best investigated group of ciliates. I should mention here perhaps that the research that I present here and much more that I'll talk at the end of the talk is actually belongs to what I call my team, which is really interdisciplinary and intercontinental, and it has both computer scientists, mathematicians, and biologists. And I've indicated the name of David Prescott, a very famous biologist, actually the one that discovered gene assembly that we'll be talking about today. To make this lecture personal, I have here a picture of one single ciliate. It's a very charming individual. I like this awfully much. And because it's so small, I call it Tom, okay? And it has these cilias here, which all of them have. This is one feature that unites all the ciliates. There are also other organisms that have them. And these are hairy structures that allow them to move actually very fast in watery solutions and also to get food to their oral openings. So let me leave this here so you just met the ciliate and it is here. What I like in a biolab is to watch through the microscope the solution where ciliates are, and when you look at them, that this is really unbelievable how chaotic they are, how quickly they move and bump into each other. And my problem is that I could not distinguish between any two of them. And that bothered me because it's not nice for any group of organisms to tell that you all look the same to me. It's also politically not correct, okay? So I've been bothered by this. And then one day what has occurred to me is that actually there may be a dual situation, maybe in the same situation, because it may be that when I look through the microscope, that's how they see me. And they really cannot distinguish between me and Prescott and other biologists. From that moment on, I don't have any complex anymore, okay? On a more formal side, then, here is what ciliates are really famous for. The only organism, this is a unique feature of ciliates, they are, as you know probably, or most of you know, eukaryotes are organisms that protect their DNA in a nucleus. So they have nucleus. Ciliates went one step further, and that's the only group of organisms that did this. They have two functionally dramatically different sort of nuclei. It's not that they have two copies of the same nucleus because there are cells that are having this, but they have two kinds of nuclei, a micronucleus and macronucleus. Macronucleus is a typical eukaryotic nucleus that is producing RNA transcripts for expression of proteins. So this is household, working household nucleus. However, they have another one that is dormant and is activated only during sexual reproduction. So I just want to also repeat once again that there are organisms that have many copies of the same one, but these are two a functionally different sort of nuclei, and actually each of them occurs, depending on the species, in various multiplicities. So this is a schematic picture, two micronuclei and two macronuclei.
So is this a male or female ciliate?
Excuse me?
Is it a male or female ciliate?
Well, it's later. I prefer to answer this in private. Okay, so. Okay. It is like this, that when you starve ciliates, when you deny them nutrients, they go to one of the three possible actions, and we don't understand which group of genes is switching them to them and why they chose one of these. And the first one is they form a cyst, and in cyst form, they can survive a probably unbelievable long times. I mean, not many people keep ciliates, but Prescott has in his lab ciliates which are frozen for 40 years. You take them, put them to warm water, give them nutrients. In 2 hours, they are dancing there, and the biologists really think that they may survive hundreds of years in a cyst form. The other thing is that they eat each other. They become cannibals. That happens sometimes to humans in the mountains of Colorado when they get stuck for a longer time. We have some famous people there. But what is very nice here, evolutionary, is that if they decide to go to this cannibalic kind of existence, what they start to do, they grow humps on their backs. And the humps are such big triangle mountains, so to say, here. And then the ones that survive are those that are the fastest in growing the hump, because if you have a big hump, you don't fit in the oral opening of another ciliate. So this is a big race for growing humps, okay? And then something which is very unusual, I mean, it's not only ciliates, but definitely different from humans, that you starve them and they go to sex, they go to sexual reproduction, okay? At some stage, this is a very involved process, but at some stage in the sexual reproduction, there is a process which is called gene assembly. I will say a few words later about that more, but at some point, a micronucleus will be transformed to a macronucleus, which means the genome of a meek will become a genome of Mac. This DNA transformation processing is the most involved in all the biology. We don't know any more involved DNA processing than this one going here. And the reason this is so involved that the genome of the meek, is dramatically different from the genome of the Mac. And because it is a short lecture, I don't have time to discuss all the differences, but I will show you one dramatic difference between the genome of meek and the genome of Mac. In very symbolic way, you can represent this like this. If you take the same gene, all the genes are present both in meek and in Mac, in both nuclei. If you take a look at the Mac, so functional expressible genome, genes are expressible and functional, then you take specific gene in specific species. Then the relationship between the MAC gene and the MIG gene is that you can cut the MAC gene in a finite number of pieces in this generic example here in 6, and then there is a fixed permutation of them, like piece number 1 becomes here number 4, piece number 2 remains 2 but is inverted, piece number 3 becomes the last one. So there is a fixed permutation of the 6 pieces, and in between this permuted sequence, additional genetic material is put in. It's non-coding. So if you look at a MAC gene and a MIG gene, this is how they are related structurally. The number of the things of the those red pieces here differ depending on which gene and which species you consider. But you can always cut this in a fixed number of pieces. There is some fixed permutation. You put in between this additional material, and then you get a MIG gene. Now, those red pieces here, when we look on the MIG gene, are called MDSs, and the green one are called IESs. These are abbreviations of some terms. But what you have to remember that during the sexual reproduction, the gene assembly is the process when the micronuclear material is transferred into macronuclear material. So this gene, which is scrambled and crazy and non-functional, will have to be transformed into this functional gene, which means that the original permutation has to be found here, established. If something was inverted, it must be reinverted, and you must create a gene like this. So this is the relationship between macronuclear and micronuclear genes, and in gene assembly, you have to transform this to this. So you can see that this is really dramatically different, and this is part of the job which ciliates have to do in the process of assembling the MAC from the MIG. In this assembly process, what is very important is the structure of these MDSs, those pieces, coding pieces of gene from the MAC which are sitting in the MIG. Each of them looks like as follows. It has a characteristic two sequences, one at the beginning of it and the one at the end of it. So for example, this one, there is a characteristic sequence here and characteristic sequence here, and that's called an incoming pointer, and that's called an outgoing pointer. So this incoming pointer is on the boundary of MDS and IES, and the same is the outgoing pointer. Now, empirically, we know that the pair itself, PI and PI plus 1, is characteristic of MDS. So MDS number 4 will have a different pair of them than MDS number 5 and so on. But the major regularity here is that the outgoing pointer of MDS number 4 will be equal to incoming pointer of MDS number 5. And outgoing of MDS number 5 will be equal to incoming MDS number 6. So if you take a micronuclear gene Somewhere in this mess, in this really bizarre form, you have MDSs and you have IESs, MDSs. Somewhere you have MDS number 4 and somewhere else sits MDS number 5. You know that the outgoing pointer of this one is equal to incoming pointer of this one. So I read this like this. The incoming pointer says, I am MDS number 4, I will be going to MDS number 5. I'm MDS number 5, I'll be going to MDS number 6.
Is the entire MDS coding?
Excuse me?
Is everything in the MDS used for coding?
Yes, MDS are pieces from functional genes, so this is all coding. Absolutely, absolutely. This is also the difficulty. So for those of you that really... from computer science, then you notice here that it is a linked list structure, because you know that you will have to put, after this one, you have to put this one, and you can treat this as addresses of this one. This is where the next one comes. But we'll talk more about that. Okay, so now I would like to correct a little bit what I told you at the beginning, because at the beginning I told you that it is here. Just for didactical reason, I told you that you cut macronuclear gene by catenation. One is catenated with two. Actually, now you know the structure of MDSs, so this was a small lie to make this didactically simpler, but it is like this. You have MDS number 1, its outgoing pointer is identical to incoming pointer of 2. Outgoing here is equal to incoming here. So what they do, they are just glued on these pieces. They fall into each other, glow on. They are glued on overlapping pieces, and you get from micronuclear gene by gluing these MDSs on their overlaps a macronuclear gene. Mind you, these pieces, this M3 and M4 may be very far in a micronuclear gene. One of them may be inverted, and that's a very complicated thing. So now, the biologists from the very beginning of discovery of this very unusual phenomenon of keeping genes in MYC in an encoded, encrypted form, and in MAC in an expressible way, that biologists were interested, what is the hardware, molecular hardware? How are MYCs assembled into MACs? Okay? And this quest for a discovery of this molecular hardware is really 30 years old, because they were really, actually everything was discovered in 71, and from the very beginning, they really were puzzled by this. The point is that also you see the pointer structure there, there's a major difficulty, and the difficulty is that the pointers may be very, very short. A pointer may be 7, but maybe also 3 base pair long. And now, randomly, you see them all the time. How would you know which is a pointer? Remember, pointer is on the boundary of MDS and IES. How do you know where boundary is? You know, so what is, how is it possible for CD8 to carry such enormously involved process? Okay, and I want to propose a solution for that. So I come now to the real kernel of my lecture, and this is telling you about how this process goes from the molecular point of view. So the solution came in the form of we proposed a new kind of recombination. It's called template-guided recombination, in which a DNA molecule from the old macronucleus enters a newly developing macronucleus and acts as a template. So let me tell you a few words how I came to this idea that's what should be tried. There was a result reported from the Paris lab, which is the following. I did not tell you about the sexual reproduction a lot, but in sexual reproduction, at some point, you arrive at the single individual. This is after conjugation, after the sexual contact took place and exchange of the material happened, that you have two micronuclei, two MYCs, and one of them will be transformed into the MAC, and the other one will stay as it is. However, up to this period and during this time, all the old material, old MACs, are digested, destroyed by the cell. which means that the walls of the nucleus are destroyed, and those functional genes from here, they start to flow in the cytoplasm. And what French discovered, and also Prescott Lab, is that genes from here can get to the developing MYC. And so the one possibility would be that cilia somehow look at the old genes, use them as a template, to produce, to put together from MYCs their MACs. Okay? So this was the general idea was that the old functional gene may be available in the MYC where it develops into MAC. So the one way that he can put together macronuclear form from this scrambled micronuclear is that he has a template to work with. And now I will be working on a to explain you the template-guided recombination. So I've prepared some things for you here. Please realize that I don't see you because this light is so strong here. I assume that somebody is still in the audience, but let me show you. So this is I told you that you should, very good way to see a double-stranded molecule is a standing picket fence, okay? A bar, so these are the backbones, and then there are these pairs here, complementary pairs, base pairs here. If you knock off the hydrogen bond, which is very easy to knock off, then those are free and available. And then if there would be, at the same time, another DNA molecule which would have this piece of backbone and this piece of backbone would be complementary, then what may happen, Moshe, can I ask you here? So, okay.
As long as I don't disappear.
That's okay. Okay. So you see what happens here is that if you knock those hydrogen bonds, then the bases here, if this is complementary with this, then they will, as they were connected, they were connected here by hydrogen bonds because they were complementary, they may now reconnect like this. So one molecule and the other molecule establish a bridge here. Okay? And then, can I ask you here? I've developed this technique after I've seen that in my lectures the session chair was sleeping several times, so now I am. Okay, so now let's make this loose here for a moment. Yeah. So now I will show you the really basic thinking. This is really what led to this whole idea. I have here, again, this one is a picket fence here. So this is a double-stranded molecule, and we knock off these bonds here. What may happen now is that this molecule will form a ceiling and a floor, okay, with one molecule. So let me just put this like this. If you will be so kind and keep this here and here. So we have a white molecule and a blue one. And white and blue one, so you can go through blue, and through this roof, you can enter the white one. Moshe, can you come to this side? Okay. And then there will be another molecule, if you can keep this here. Okay. Is anybody making pictures of these two gentlemen? So so now what we have here is that this is a molecule, DNA molecule. This is what I call a template. A third molecule that interacts between these two and make a connection between them possible. So this here is the crux of the matter. If you understand this, that you may have one molecule, we kick off hydrogen bonds, part of this connects with this one and part with this one. What is important to know is that this is one molecule. This may be two different molecules, or maybe it is the same one which winds like this. But anyhow, you have an intermediate molecule for recombining two others, okay? Thank you very much. You don't go too far away because you'll be needed, okay? So this is my best attempt to illustrate this in a linear form. So What you need here is what we have seen there. You need a template here, which is intermediate molecule, and you want this to act to recombine X and Y through the template. In order to do that, you need to have that the X molecule and template are complementary. You see this alpha, and this is complement of this alpha bar. So if the first base pair here is A, then it will be T here, complementary pairs. But there is a piece alpha, then a piece beta. Forget that it's divided into beta 1, beta 2 at that moment, and then delta. On the piece alpha beta is complementary to piece alpha bar beta bar on the template. And what is very important that from the first nucleotide on of delta, they are not complementary. So delta and gamma will not align. They are not complementary. And here, symmetrically, if you go on Y from this side, then there is a piece gamma and a piece beta, which are complementary with gamma bar and beta bar here, and there is a piece epsilon, which is not complementary with this alpha. So it is illustrated here that if they stand up as picket fences, and this upper backbone here is 5 prime, so this will be 3 prime, and they will be complementary, then you have this alpha beta on the template and alpha beta on the X are complementary, and from this moment on, not anymore, so it will not align, it goes away. In the same way, you have a gamma beta here, and you have a gamma beta here, and epsilon is not complementary. Then, remember what we did, we knocked off the hydrogen bonds, and because this alpha and alpha bar and beta bar were complementary, then what we got here is a formation of a roof and down there of the floor, and it will use a part of beta, say we call this beta 1. In a moment I explain this. And then symmetrically from this part, we'll have a gamma and the remaining part of beta, so beta 2, will establish a roof here and the floor. So you can see you can walk on the molecule X, first a vertical part, then you go and you are on the roof of this and you transfer to the, so this roof between X and T, you transfer to the roof between T and Y, and so in this way you get a connection of X with Y through the template. Just occurs to me when I look at that, that it looks like a piano made out of DNA. I didn't notice this because in a, it looks pretty good here. Okay. So, I'm looking at this configuration here from the bird's point of view, and I make a cut in this backbone here. Remember this phosphodiester bond, and I can cut. So because this and this aligned here, this is the roof formed here and the roof formed here, I want to cut everything where the roof ends. I cut this off. So I take scissors, molecular scissors, and I cut this off. In the same way, because this here is not used, I cut this off. In the same way, so for every, so I'm on the roof pieces, I'm cutting off here, and then cut here and cut here. So the structure that I'm getting now when I perform these cuts I need a helper here. A volunteer. Okay. Okay, if you would be so kind and keep this here. So please notice that when I make the cut, so this is where you have molecule X and it formed, maybe we'll go to the middle here, molecule X and it formed the roof with a template, and then the other part here formed the roof between template and Y and Y. So X and Y are standing and you can walk on the roof here. Now, what will happen now, this is the most important observation I want you to make, is that, so this is cut off, so we have from the template we have only this backbone. Imagine that this is very heavy, it sinks down. So when this sinks down, you have this rotation here that happens. Okay, so we can keep this in this way. So this is roof. And then when it collapses, then this thing happens. So when this happens, you get this molecule. Please notice how brilliant it is, because it is X. This part here is X and complementary part from T. But because this is X, then it's identical as it was in X. So everything till here, also it using part from T, is really X as it was. And similarly, this is Y. The upper here bases are from Y, and this come from the template, but they are complementary, so it's exactly like it was in Y. So what I got with this one molecule, now by collapsing of the roof, I got X recombined with Y. It so happens that physical pieces here are coming from T. But just if I go from this roof configuration, by collapsing, I got X and Y recombined using physically pieces from T. Okay? So this is, thank you. Okay. This is a most important observation that we have here. And so if I have this and this here collapses, then I am getting this molecule, standing picket fence. In red, I indicated what comes from X. In green, what comes from Y. And then in blue, what comes from T. But this all comes from X, so everything complementary is as it was in X. Also, I'm using template. And I'm using template, but I reconstitute here Y. So what happened, clearly, you lack a bond here, and you lack a bond here, and you lack, but there is a ligase in the soup, and it will this. So what we did by collapsing of the roof, we recombined X and Y. So this is a first important thing. So you almost understood the most important part about template-guided recombination. Now I look at our basic configuration. Remember X, template, and Y, and then alpha, beta complementary to alpha, beta here, and gamma, beta complementary to gamma, beta here. And now we are making cuts on the floor here. Everything that is outside here, I cut this bond, and I cut this bond, and I cut this, and I cut this. And when I do these cuts, then I am getting this molecule here. So there is a template. This template is standing vertically, and then there is a floor between template and X, and there is a floor between template and Y, and template is standing here. So this is the last paper plane I have for you here. So would you be so kind? Okay. It's hard work to be a session chair. Okay, yeah, you just keep this here. Oh, okay. So we have a template standing here, and template has a floor. Oh, actually, because X is on the other side. Okay. Template is having floor with X, and it's having floor with Y. And the only transformation that happens now is a trivial from biological point of view. There is a rotation of these floors. They come up. What did you get when the floors rotated like this? I mean, there will be protein that will bring this to rotation. Well, there's a template. Then there is a piece of a template and complementary piece from X. The piece of template, complementary piece of Y. But this is all template, so it is like it was in template anyhow, because it's complementary, and a template there. By raising floors, we reconstituted the template. Not only the template took place in recombination, as a part of recombination, it got reconstituted. It's ready again to work. Okay? Thank you. So this is what happened. We raise these floors. We got this molecule. Everything is template. Ligase will seal this nix here, and we got template reconstituted. So the last observation is that when I look at the original picture, we had a molecule X, molecule T, and molecule Y here. There was a ceiling here. There was a roof underneath. We cut this here in the roof part, and down there exactly the same place in the ceiling. We cut this in the roof and down there in the ceiling. So this part, which is shaded here, will fly away. It's cut, physically cut off with scissors. And this is also cut away and will be flying away. So if I can put this on one transparency, this piece is loose now, and the upper piece is loose now. So all together, when we apply this template guided recombination in this special configuration I showed you, four molecules are created. First of all, by collapsing of the roof, X and Y recombine. You get recombination of X and Y. By raising of the floors, template is reconstituted. Pieces of it were used in the first part, but then it's reconstituted. And then the two pieces are flying away. So now I can summarize this by two diagrams. When we start, then you have a template, and there is a molecule X which attaches on some piece here, alpha, beta, to T. It means it aligns here because it's complementary to this one. There is a molecule Y which attaches or aligns on gamma, beta here. Perhaps it aligns even further, I don't care, but what is very important that already from the first nucleotide is not complementary here, it goes away, and epsilon is not complementary here, it goes away. When all this, I call this acrobatics of DNA, maybe you prefer the name Cirque du Soleil for DNA molecules, then you get this situation, okay? So as a result of this, template got reconstituted, X and Y recombined, and I got two additional molecules. Maybe
why do you say recombined, not combined?
The name used is recombination. You recombine two molecules into. This is a technical term. This is difficult to hear because this. Okay.
Has all of T gone away?
T got reconstituted. Nothing got lost from T. The flowing pieces away is from X and from Y. But remember, if X and Y is the same molecule, then this piece that goes away is the same as this one here. So let me show you this in the context of what I was telling you about, because this is, in general, recombination. This is when we look how you put together MDSs by overlap to create macronuclear gene. So template is old gene from macronucleus. It's functional MAC, so it is our template. Remember, it came from old MAC, and it entered this unlag, this forming MIC into MAC. And then somewhere on micronuclear gene, you have a MDS number 4, which starts with a pointer number 4, ends with a pointer number 5, because it exists in the MAC gene, so it will align on all these portions with this. And in the same way, so then there is an IES, remember on a, suppose that I have in my micronuclear gene, I have MDS number 4, IES in between, followed by MDS number 5. So MDS number 4 exists in functional gene because these were red pieces that came from functional gene. This is the green piece, does not exist at all in a MAC, so it's just loose. It's definitely not aligned here. It will be cut away in a moment. And then here is again MDS number 5. The pointer, outgoing pointer of MDS number 4 and incoming of MDS number 5 are identical. Please notice that the definition of pointer is now, pointer is exactly this piece which is aligned in all three molecules. So now you know exactly what is pointer. Don't need any artificial definition of this. It's just from the point of view of molecular hardware. The pieces where both X, template, and Y align, all three are aligned. This our beta, this is the pointer. And then somewhere here will be division into beta 1 and beta 2, and here also, and this piece will fly away, and these things will recombine, and I will get X and Y recombined through this pointer. So MDS4 and MDS5 will form now a bigger composed MDS, combination of 4 and 5. In the same way, through the whole gene, I will recombine all of them and will form the MAC. And those pieces will fly away. So if I want to put this in a symbolic form that we are used very much in computer science, then please notice what we have. In X, I have a template. Template has three pieces, alpha, beta, gamma. Then on the X, I have alpha, beta, which are complementary to this. I did not write bars because it's only that you flip this over. So alpha, beta, and alpha, beta are identical here. And on Y and T are identical, or gamma, beta, and gamma, beta. When the recombination, template-guided recombination takes place, we reconstitute the template. We recombined X and Y through template because alpha glued through beta and with gamma will give me X recombined with Y. And there will be two pieces that are flying away. What is here, if you look at this in the symbolic form, you immediately notice two things here that in some way were at that time sensational, because you use a template to recombine two molecules. I did not tell you details about biology, about chromosomes there, but one template would be never enough. You need at least 128 templates because there will be a chromosome will consist of 128 copies. And then even if one old gene will succeed to go through cytoplasm, which is a jungle to go through, then you have no guarantee that it will use, that you have enough of them to recombine everything. But here is really self-propagator. So once I did this, I have my template reconstituted, and this recombination X and Y is also template. It has already a good piece, alpha, beta, gamma. It can act as a template. So one application of a template produces me two templates, so you have exponential growth. In no time whatsoever, you get enormous number of templates there, okay? And the second thing is, which is very important, if you look on left and right side, so you say this is template, in order to be a template, a part of the molecule be template for the other one, you must have this regularity. There must be alpha, beta, gamma here, and the one molecule which you want to recombine with the other one should have, this should have alpha, beta, and that should have beta, gamma. And if you inspect all of the four pieces here, none of them can be template for the others. Okay? Which means that template-guided recombination is irreversible. The recombination that happens in our body all the time, in meiosis, all this, is reversible. And people in ciliates knew because, again, I did not have time to tell you this, but if you look on axioms of what happens in ciliates, one of the axioms is that whatever is going on must be irreversible. So the normal recombination teaser could not work. Okay, so you have here an example of irreversible recombination. So the process of recombining is irreversible. Templates are produced in exponential way. We have always enough of them. Maybe then remember at the beginning there were worries because pointers were very short. You cannot align on pointers. This model shows you pointers are only part of alignment. Alignment is made on MDSs that I just showed you. MDSs are huge. These are hundreds of base pairs. So alignment is very, very steady. And the role of pointers is only to point out where the cut was within beta, divided beta and beta 1 and beta 2. Okay, so I would like to come up to the summary here. Template-guided recombination model provides satisfactory solution to several crucial problems. Remember, we said, how would ciliate be able to identify where pointers are? It's automatically now. Pointers are those pieces that are aligned on all three molecules, template X and Y. The boundary is determined precisely in the same way. We got irreversible recombination. You got self-propagation of templates. And also what I did not mention, which is very important here, that was one of the weaknesses of previous half explanations, is that the whole mechanism is sequence specific. The only thing which we need is specific configuration, the three standing picket fences must be aligned in some way. Whether it's aligned on the sequences A, C, G, T, or any other, it's irrelevant. It only can happen, I had no time to discuss how molecular complexes work on this alignment and what they do, but it's totally irrelevant what kind of sequence is there, but only what configuration is formed. So altogether, this provides a solution to a problem that was really crucial, maybe one of the couple of most important problems in biology of ciliates, where we looked up at this idea that it must be some kind of acrobatic templating there. Then a number of biologists were rather skeptic, and some well-known personalities were also skeptic. But what happens is that we got the following. So this provided a solution to a problem which was open for actually more than 30 years. As I told you, we want to understand bioware. For example, from the point of view of DNA computing, we want to know exactly what is process, what is biomolecular hardware. What are the? You can see this in some way, that you have a pointer structure and you are asking yourself, what is implementing this pointer structure? And the answer is, it must be template-guided recombination. It is an interesting source for formulating theoretical problems. So I would like to finish my lecture by actually giving you a small summary on a couple of transparencies about the research on ciliates. The only thing that I showed you today is one piece of research which was concerned with discovery of the molecular hardware. However, let's look up at what has happened from the point of view of biology first. I really consider this research, there are other groups working on these problems also, as a very successful interdisciplinary cooperation of biologists and mathematicians, computer scientists, and it brought really interesting results and fruits for both groups. So what I did not show you today is that there are formal systems which are some special kind of rewriting, which is called the reduction, which you can present on graphs or on strings, and you can reason formally about gene assembly, possible strategies how genes are assembled, create new conjectures, experiment. There is a software available, and biologists run this and have a conjecture and then try to see whether they can make an experiment on this. There is a, before this interdisciplinary cooperation started, there are hundreds of papers written on gene assembly. Each time biologists would sequence a micronuclear gene, there would be a paper when they would show how this scrambled thing by really unbelievable knotting, looping, and all this could recombine synchronously and give you macronuclear gene. But my question was always to them, first of all, each time you get different explanation, and the second one, that if it is not synchronous, then you lose the gene, and the rate of success here is unbelievably big. So we got now uniform explanation of gene assembly for all experimental data. We got a solution to this problem. I could also report that about 2 months ago, we have solved another, maybe even more important problem, purely in biology, because the question is how the scrambling came about. I mean, we deal how to unscramble this. But why ciliates developed this scrambling? When did it happen in evolution? And what was the reason for that? Okay? And this was also solved very recently. From the computer science point of view, ciliates were, I can only say, fantastic. There are very many people working on them, both in bioinformatics and theoretical computer science. First of all, I did not show you today because there is definitely not enough time, mathematical theory of this recombination. Amazing thing is that when you formalize this in mathematical way and forget about ciliates, do just mathematics of this, then the very fundamental results on the structure of words came in. They are so fundamental. I spent so many years in working on structure of words and languages that I think that these results will be definitely taught in the future as basic results of structure. In short, the result says there are no random words. Whenever we give me any word, I can show you always a specific parsing structure in it. Okay? Then, independently of template-guided recombination, there are many challenging questions and models and enormous wealth of the problems to work on. There is a book here that appeared actually at the beginning of the year, last year, and by now it's there is at least that much material that is not in the book, but it covers basic biology of the cell, basic biology of ciliates, and a lot of mathematics, we also including challenging problems. There is this new computing paradigm that you can think now of making computations in the way that molecules act in a cell. So you may have a molecule folds on itself, recombines, and you get a new molecule. If you consider molecule as a data structure, then by folding, recombining, you get a new data structure. So what kind of a data structure are getting, what kind of computations are possible in this way? And from my point of view, the most important thing is that the research on ciliates, like a lot of research in natural computing, brings a broader and novel understanding of the notion of computation. Okay? I've been so impressed by how much ciliates contributed to computer science that I decided to nominate them for the Turing Award. This is the highest prize. And actually, I wrote a nomination, sent this to the chairman of the nominating committee, and I got very short answer back that unicellular organisms are not eligible for this prize. And I myself think that this is discrimination, but since we are in France, as French say, c'est la vie, so I kind of accept this. Okay, now let me finish by two transparencies. So one is, if you'd like to look into these things, this is the paper, biological paper, which introduces template-guided recombination in more details and also talks about feasibility of this in biology, proteins that perform this raising of the floors and all this. And this is the book that I have mentioned. If you are interested, you can have a look into this, which really summarizes a lot of research on CDs. But it also, for students of computer science, it has a really very nice chapter on general biology of the cell for computer scientists, and also biology of the ciliate for computer scientists. And then it starts with model forming and mathematics. So let me put this one here. And finally, let me thank you for your attention. Thank you very much. If you want to see an example of a scrambled something, not a gene, these are my transparencies after the lecture.